Now it's time to join Graham Easton for this week's case notes.
Hello. They may be the smallest living organisms, and when doctors tell you it's a virus, they usually mean there's nothing much to worry about, and not much they can do about it anyway. But viruses do have a strangely intimate relationship with us, and on occasions they can be real trouble. Their sole purpose is to make more of themselves, and they're extremely hard to kill off. Today, with the help of my guest, virologist Professor John Oxford from Queen Mary School of Medicine in London, I'll be exploring the mysterious world of viruses, from the common types that cause flu, shingles or warts, to the lethal kinds like the one now spreading serious pneumonia across the world at the speed of a jumbo jet. Professor Oxford, thanks very much for coming in. There are lots of different types of viruses, but can you give us a picture of what a typical virus looks like, if you can?
Well, they're wonderful looking things, these viruses. Typically, they are round, like a donut, and typically they have little spikes sticking out from the donut, which could give them a hedgehog sort of appearance. Some of them are more exotic than that, and they come in the shape like a bola of a shepherd's crook. And some of them can be fairly large, much smaller than a bacterium, and such an example is the brick-shaped virus which causes smallpox.
And part of their purpose is to get inside human cells, is that the idea?
They won't have any kind of replicative ability outside a human cell. They've got to get their genes, their genetic information, from their little sphere into the cell. And they kind of program the cell, in a sense.
Like hijacking it, in a way.
Like hijacking it, like, in a sense, like putting your credit card into a machine and out comes your pound notes. And it's almost like that. They're putting genetic information into the nucleus, usually of a cell, and then they take over the cell. And instead of the cell producing housekeeping proteins in the normal way it would behave, it starts producing more and more viruses. That's the way they operate.
The other aspect of viruses is their infectiousness. Can you compare, for instance, the infectiousness of, say, measles with this new virus, the one behind the severe acute respiratory syndrome?
It's a difficult concept, this infectiousness, but I think it's a very useful concept, actually. And yes, you can list them. For example, high up on the list of infectious viruses would be something like measles, our old friend, who's almost vanquished now, influenza. And in those examples, you see, you could walk into a room, I could walk into a lecture room full of students, and if I were incubating measles and none of the students had been vaccinated, they would all catch it, all 300 of them. Now, a virus at the bottom of the list, transmitted by aerosol in the same way, something like smallpox, I would literally have to dance with one of the students to get that student infected. The rest of them wouldn't get infected at all. So, yes, high infectiousness and low infectiousness. Quite an important concept.
Well, thank you. Now, I'd like to introduce you to one of the biggest families in the viral world, the herpes family. Actually, you've probably already met. The herpes viruses are responsible for cold sores, glandular fever, and genital herpes. But one of the most interesting and problematic herpes viruses is varicella zoster. It's the virus behind both chickenpox and shingles, the painful rash with small crusting blisters. And the fact that it does cause both chickenpox and shingles can get a bit confusing. Can you catch shingles from a child with chickenpox? Can you get chickenpox from granny's shingles? Well, our reporter Leslie Hilton has been finding out from the experts, including Jill Killington, who's had shingles twice now, the first time when she was in her 20s.
Just some red spots and itchy lumps around from the front of my body round the right hand side to the back, to my back. It followed a quite distinct line, and the pain wasn't constant. It would probably range from a kind of hot stabbing kind of pain every so often to a dull kind of throb, and then sometimes it was not uncomfortable at all.
You can only get shingles if you've already had chickenpox, because the virus lies dormant in the roots of the nerves, often for many years. When it's reactivated, it travels back via the nerve pathways to the skin, causing a rash which is characteristically only on one side of the body, where it corresponds to the position of the nerve paths. In younger patients, the condition is often quite mild and may only require painkillers, but for other groups of patients it can be more severe. Dr. Anthony Hale is a consultant virologist at the Leeds Public Health Laboratory.
The symptoms can be much more severe, particularly in older people or people who are immunocompromised or people with particular complications of shingles. And in those circumstances, antiviral treatment can be used effectively. There are a number of drugs on the market now. One is acyclovir, which has been around for a long time and has been proven to be useful in this treating this infection. There are now two other newer drugs on the market, one called famciclovir and one called valacyclovir. They're a little more expensive, but they do seem to be probably better in that you don't need to take them as often during the day.
Some patients experience severe pain during shingles. If the pain persists for more than 30 days, it's called post-herpetic neuralgia. It's more likely to occur in the over 60s, and it causes one of the most severe pains that the body can experience. Dr. Karen Simpson is a consultant in pain management at St. James's Hospital, Leeds.
It's severe because it's due to nerve damage. It's not the kind of pain we normally experience. Normally, if you have a tissue injury, pain is transmitted in the normal pathways in the nervous system. But when you get the pain of shingles, it's due to damage and the pain is transmitted in abnormal pathways and it's outside our normal experience. So it's very, very painful.
Jill Killington is one of the 4% of people who get shingles more than once. She's now in her early 50s, and this attack is much more serious than the first. This time, the virus has reached her eye, and she's been suffering for months.
My eyes were red, very uncomfortable, this peculiar pain, very light sensitive. My vision is still very impaired in my right eye. Luckily, I only got it in one eye. If my left eye was as bad as the right one, I would not be able to function at all.
There's a lot of confusion about who can or can't get shingles. For example, sometimes grandparents think that they shouldn't visit a grandchild suffering from chickenpox because they might get shingles. In fact, it can't be contracted that way. The only way to get shingles is if the virus already in the nerves is reactivated. But it is possible, although rare, for an adult with shingles to give chickenpox to a child. And doctors are wary about pregnant women catching chickenpox or shingles. Last year, a vaccine was licensed in the UK to protect adults and children over the age of 12 against chickenpox. It's aimed at specific groups of people, such as hospital workers or women who are planning to become pregnant. Anthony Hale.
Chickenpox can be quite a severe disease in adults. It's often quite a trivial disease in children, but in adults it can be quite a severe disease. Some evidence has shown that, particularly in pregnancy, that chickenpox can be more severe and more likely to lead to complications in the pregnancy. So that's one reason we try to avoid chickenpox during pregnancy, as well as the small risk of it affecting the fetus. Shingles, which again can occur during pregnancy, does not affect the pregnancy at all and is no risk.
We seem to hear about more cases of shingles these days, so is it becoming more common? Although there are only around 3 cases per 1,000 every year, it's a condition which is more likely to appear in the elderly. And as the older generation make up an increasingly larger section of our population, so more cases of shingles will be diagnosed. It's not known what triggers the reactivation of the virus, but stress is one possibility. Shingles isn't a notifiable disease, so there's no real evidence that younger people are getting it. But Dr. Dick Killington, a virologist at the University of Leeds, has noted some interesting studies.
If we look at actually the spread of shingles in terms of age range, about 3/4 of all shingles cases are in people over the age of 50. But there have been a number of small epidemiological trials where they've looked at, or particularly one particular one that I know was done in the USA, where they looked at a number of young, upwardly mobile individuals who led a very stressful life, and that the paper reported that the incidence of shingles amongst them was possibly higher than it ought to be amongst people of their age group.
Dick Killington ending that report from Leslie Hilton. You're listening to Case Notes on BBC Radio 4, and I'm talking viruses with Professor John Oxford. John, we were hearing there about some of the antiviral treatments that are available for conditions like herpes zoster shingles. And I should think a lot of people will be familiar with using antivirals for cold sores, another herpes virus, herpes simplex. But why do they have to be taken sort of early on in the infection, just as symptoms appear, for them to be any good?
Well, they are very tight in their activity. that's the first thing to remember about these antiviral drugs compared to antibacterials, compared to penicillin. We would all love to have a penicillin against viruses, but we haven't got them. We've got acyclovir, which only acts against herpes. We've got Relenza, which only acts against influenza. You can't move from family to family. You can use them in two different ways, actually. You can use these antivirals to prevent yourself getting infected. And some people who have recurrent herpes, say genital, sexually transmitted genital herpes, they can take and do take acyclovir for all their life.
How does it work in a nutshell? I mean, how do they work?
The acyclovir drug works wonderfully, as I would love every other antiviral drug to work, but unfortunately most of them don't. But it's very specific. For example, it will only enter a cell infected with a herpes virus. It won't go in to a normal cell. And once inside that virus-infected cell, it targets a specific herpes enzyme. So it's like an Exocet missile, you see, targeting that herpes enzyme and knocking it out. So the herpes virus cannot replicate, whereas the cell can go on behaving as normal.
Now, I've got to ask you about the new virus that's emerged in the Far East that's causing severe acute respiratory syndrome. Let's start at the beginning and how it may have appeared, how it may have developed. How do you suddenly get a new virus like that?
Well, of course, we're in the crystal ball gazing arena here. Nevertheless, we can narrow it down to two possibilities. One is that this virus is, which we think may be a coronavirus or a paramyxovirus from those two families.
Which is part of the common cold type family virus.
Both of them. We've been very laid back, I would say, with both those families. We've viewed them as causing mild infections. So it will come as a surprise either way if one of them turns out to be the causative agent of this. But either of them, actually, from those two families, those viruses could have emerged from humans. They could have been there all the time and we've missed them. Quite possible, very possible. Or, alternatively, it could have come from the great reservoir of viruses like from birds and from animals, particularly in that area of the world. So you've got two possibilities. It does look as though they emerged, if they did, or they came from the humans or the birds, probably several months ago, probably November or even earlier.
And they changed something about their genetic makeup to enable them to travel from one species to another suddenly, or to become infected when they weren't before, or
it's not easy for a virus actually to jump this species barrier, but they do it, and we've got plenty of good examples like HIV and hepatitis B. So they have to mutate. Obviously, as the population increases in the world, as we move into areas we've never been before, we're going to come across strange and weird animals and get infections from them we've never experienced before. So I think this sort of opportunity is going to become more and more common.
I'm fascinated to know how you go about tracking down a virus like that, because there must be millions of people with symptoms similar to severe acute respiratory syndrome, you know, cough, sore throat. These are the symptoms I've been hearing about, fever. How do you track it down?
Well, it's not easy to pinpoint a virus to a particular disease. And I think the most difficult area is in this respiratory virology area, the very one we're talking about, the SARS. So what you have to do, you have to take a sample from the respiratory tract. And of course, it's very difficult to get a lung sample. You know, so usually you're restricted to a sample from the upper airways.
So throat or nose.
That's right. And there you can't be absolutely sure that the virus that you isolate from that area is the one actually causing the disease in the lung. So it's one thing just looking down your electron microscope and shouting Eureka because I see a paramyxovirus or I see a coronavirus. It's another thing convincing the scientific world that it's the causative agent. And there you have to go even further. You have to look at the immune reaction of the patient to that particular virus and demonstrate quite clearly that that patient who has had the disease has then developed immunity to that particular virus, has developed antibodies to that virus. And so you normally have to wait a couple of weeks for that to happen. And then having demonstrated that, you more or less these days have to do a genetic footprint of that virus and prove to everyone, including yourself, that it's a new virus. It's not some common old garden old thing that we've all known about all these years, that something new has happened. And you've got those three things, you're on the way.
Can I just ask you then for some sort of fairly practical advice on this? Do we know how infectious it is? And whether people should be avoiding travelling to the Far East, wearing masks, all sorts of things.
I think we've got some indication at the moment that it's not as infectious, certainly nothing like as infectious as influenza or measles. It's down towards the bottom of the list. We can deduce that from the fact that outbreaks are occurring in hospitals, in factories, in fairly closed communities and families. It's not widespread at the moment in the community. So I think that makes you feel more relaxed about it. As for avoiding travel to Hong Kong, I don't think one need think in those ways at the moment. I would certainly not avoid travel to Hong Kong. I don't see why I should go to Hong Kong with a population of 7 million people and be so unlucky as to come across one person and get infected with this virus. I don't view it that way myself.
Okay, thank you. And we should say, though, that since the 2nd of April, the Department of Health has advised against travelling to Hong Kong and Guangdong. You can get up-to-date travel advice on the Department of Health website at www.doh.gov, that's gov.uk. Well, fortunately, most of the viruses that you're likely to come into contact with are not serious. And that doesn't help you much, though, with your coughs and sneezes and sore throats. Your doctor is likely to tell you it's a virus, go home, dose up on paracetamol and fluids, and wait for it to burn itself out. But how does he or she know it's really a virus? Is it a concrete diagnosis, or just a rather vague fob-off? Here's Essex GP Dr. Keith Hopcroft with his view from the surgery.
Got a snuffle, or a sore throat, or an iffy tummy? Guess what? It's a virus. Oh, come on, you protest, between sneezes, croaks and trips to the toilet. You GPs are always saying that. Fair point. It's become such a cliché that I actually get very self-conscious about diagnosing viruses these days. Especially as, once in virus autodoc mode, I can't stop myself from spouting other hackneyed GP catchphrases, such as, there's a lot of it about. By the time the consultation has degenerated into this pantomime of clichés, it's all I can do to stop myself asking the patient, been anywhere nice on your holidays yet? So why do we GPs resort so frequently to the it's a virus line? Simply because it usually is. And even if it isn't, then whatever it is will probably go away on its own in a week or so. Just like a virus, in fact, so it might as well have been one in the first place. It's not that we GPs are ashamed of admitting we're not really sure what's wrong. It's just that it's a virus can be a useful code for let's wait and see. A pragmatic approach which saves the patient from unnecessary anxiety and me from sounding ignorant. I admit, though, that perhaps we docs have overplayed this strategy. It really isn't acceptable to see your GP with, say, an axe buried in your skull, only to be told, it's probably a virus. Try some aspirin and call again in the morning if you're no better. But what does a virus really look like? A lunar module, in fact, only a bit smaller. And instead of landing on the moon, it tends to land on me once you've coughed or sneezed it in my direction. Which is why, when a patient asks me, why do you always tell me it's a virus? I really want to reply, why do you always bring your viruses to me? But I don't, because I'm kind, and the patient's already upset enough at my unimaginative diagnosis. Besides, what the patient tends to hear is, it's just a virus, possibly because that's often what we say. This may come across as the doctor trivialising the symptoms, whereas in fact, we're just trying to reassure that it isn't anything serious, because some viruses are. Think HIV, hepatitis and Ebola. Thankfully, GPs usually deal with viruses which are annoying rather than life-threatening, which is obviously good news. But sometimes, patients want a sexy label for their illness to justify to friends and relations why they've been demanding paracetamol and attention. And while they're not wishing Ebola upon themselves, the just a virus label simply doesn't cut the mustard. So perhaps we GPs should start being a bit more expansive or technical with our diagnoses. You might, for example, be quite chuffed to hear you are suffering from the rhinovirus, which you'd imagine might be the African safari version of foot and mouth. It certainly sounds more impressive than a cold, which is what it is. Anyway, the good news for those of you bored with the diagnosis of a virus is that we GPs now have a new catch-all label, which is stress. I haven't the time to go into detail, but if it's no better in the morning and you've already tried aspirin, then it's probably stress. No, honestly, there's a lot of it about. Been anywhere nice on your holidays yet?
Dr. Keith Hopcroft. So, John Oxford, as a virologist, do you think GPs perhaps could be using proper blood tests for viruses rather than just using clinical acumen to spot things? Are they any good at just using spotting?
Well, I think we're on a turning point at the moment. There are now, for the first time, coming molecular tests, rapid tests. You know, real, not the sort of thing you have to wait for 2 hours, but you can get the result in 10 minutes. So I can see the horizon coming towards us, actually, in a year's time, 2 years' time. One could use these very rapid tests. But meanwhile, actually, I think general practitioners are rather good at diagnosing, and in my particular interest, influenza, they can get it right 7 times out of 10.
Now, I just wanted to ask you, a rather strange characteristic of viruses is their link with some cancers. How does that work?
Well, a number of viruses, like human papillomavirus, perhaps herpes virus, some of the retroviruses, they can snuggle in quite tightly into the genetic machinery of the cell. They can get very close in to the DNA of the cell, and they can transform it. They have oncogenes. They can cause mutations in the genome, and thereby set a trail of events starting, which will eventually turn out to be cancer.
And which viruses are particularly linked in that way to cancers?
The viruses that were most linked will be some of the retroviruses, human T-cell leukemia virus, one of the first real leukemia cancer viruses discovered by the Americans. But the human papillomaviruses, the common or garden wart viruses, some of those members of that family are tightly associated with causing cancer.
Particularly cervical cancer?
Yes.
Yep. Well, there's another type of growth caused by a virus, the common wart. The virus that causes warts and verrucas on your feet is a type of human papillomavirus. Warts are extremely common and very unlikely to do you any physical harm, but there is some social stigma associated with them. They can be painful, and lots of people try all sorts of things to get rid of them. And there are lots of options, from painting special solutions on them to freezing them off with cryotherapy. But do any of them actually work? Is one any better than the others? Well, consultant dermatologist Dr. Sam Gibbs at the Ipswich Hospital decided to find out by trawling through all the relevant studies he could find. Before he told me his rather surprising results, he explained how warts come about in the first place.
What happens is the virus is probably introduced to the superficial part of the skin when there's a small scratch, so, and that's why warts are more common at sites of minor trauma to the skin, so the hands and feet are the most common sites. And what happens, the virus infects the epidermal cells, which are the ones on the outside of the skin. It goes inside the cell and makes them proliferate or multiply. So you get an overgrowth of epidermal cells, and that overgrowth is what is the wart. It's really just an excess of epidermal cells at that one point.
What happens if you do nothing to a wart then? What's its natural history?
Warts, if left alone, will sit in the skin and they may grow a bit. Usually they'll just sit there doing not very much, and if you leave it alone, eventually it will go away after a matter of months or possibly years.
So when it comes to balancing the benefits and risks of treatment, what sort of things go through your mind as a dermatologist?
A lot of the treatments we have are quite labour-intensive. In other words, you're asking the patient to do quite a lot. They need to paint something on every day, probably for a number of months, or you're going to do something to the wart which is going to be quite painful. And if warts are harmless, which the vast majority of them are completely harmless, and they'll go away by themselves, it's obviously much better if it's acceptable to leave it alone and wait for it to go away by itself. And many people are not too bothered by warts, especially if they're not very visible. But on the other hand, if you've got a crop of warts on your face or on your hands, and your hands are visible in your work or when you're talking to people, some people feel very self-conscious about them. They don't like them, and they'll do anything to get rid of them. Here we go. So it's the tip. This is quite a painful place, unfortunately, and it's a very common site for warts. Here we go. Let me know when it starts to hurt. Right, are you feeling that?
Yeah, it's feeling pretty numb now.
Okay.
It's beginning to hurt now, yeah.
All right, I'm just going to go on for a little bit longer. I'll stop now.
Thank you very much, because I would have about to kick you in.
All right, I'll see you again in about 2 or 3 weeks.
Yes, I think I might manage that.
Okay.
I know how she feels, but is it worth all the pain? Well, Dr. Gibbs and his colleagues have trawled through all the relevant trials of wart treatments to see which, if any, really work. Surprisingly, perhaps, for most treatments, there really isn't much evidence that they help. Even lasers, injections of powerful drugs into the wart, or topical chemotherapy creams. Cryotherapy, or freezing the warts, didn't come out very well either.
Well, freezing warts is a very popular treatment with doctors and patients, but in fact the evidence that it works is very scanty. There are very few good trials that show that it is effective, and there are one or two smallish trials which show quite clearly that it's no better than the simple paints containing salicylic acid, so I'm not a great fan of it as a treatment.
What about the other range of treatments then that you looked at? Were there any that stuck out as good or completely useless?
The best evidence is for paints that contain salicylic acid, and these definitely do work, and they're better than what we call a placebo, which is a similar thing but which doesn't contain anything in it.
How are they meant to work?
Well, salicylic acid softens keratin, which is what most of the wart is made of. It's what consists of the outer layer of the skin, and it softens and dissolves that, and it probably also irritates the wart slightly and encourages an immune reaction against the virus.
So where does that sort of leave us, particularly people who might, you know, actually reasonably happy to live with warts and verrucas, but if they had a chance to get rid of it on their own without going to the doctor, they try something. What would be your advice?
Well, my advice is always, if possible, leave the warts alone, and they will go by themselves, but it may take time. It may take 2 years, even longer than that, for warts to disappear. If you can't bear to wait that long, and I'm very sympathetic with people who don't feel they want to do that, then I think the thing to do is to use one of these salicylic acid paints or plasters or whatever, some way of putting salicylic acid on the wart on a daily basis, probably for 3 or even 6 months.
You can get those over the counter?
Indeed you can. You can buy them over the counter very easily, and some of them are really quite convenient and easy to use. Very cheap.
Dr. Sam Gibbs. So, John, finally, will we ever get on top of viruses, do you think?
Well, there have been some wonderful achievements in conquering viruses, and I suppose the most amazing achievement was to eradicate smallpox. And there are other viruses in the sites targeting. Polio is one. We will, I think, eradicate polio by the year 2005, and then by the year 2050, hepatitis B. So there have been some fantastic achievements. But on the other hand, we have to be very careful. We have to keep our eye on the ball. We must keep a focus on these viruses. They are threatening. You know, hepatitis C, hep A, influenza, pandemic flu. They can threaten us. They do threaten us. So we cannot afford to be diverted into any way, bioterrorism, anything like that. We must keep our eye on the great natural infections of this planet.
Professor John Oxford, thank you very much for joining me. Our action line has more details about shingles, warts, and many of the other things we've been talking about. You can call them for free on 0800 044 044. Next week, high tech meets low weight, neonatal medicine.
Case Notes was presented by Graham Easton and produced by Pam Rutherford.